So the project or the paper today draws on two projects, one on infrastructure in the in-between city and one on diversity in public space. And to talk about citizenship in the in-between city, what I'm going to do is first tell you some thoughts I have about citizenship, how I approach that concept, the different ways it's been approached by other scholars and what I'm drawing from that. And then I will tell you a little bit more about what the in-between city is. It's been suggested to me that Milton Keynes actually might be a partial example anyway of that, so you can tell me at the end if that's the case. And after I've talked about citizenship and the in-between city itself, I'm going to tell you what I think happens when you contemplate and perhaps try to exercise citizenship within the in-between city and why it matters. So I'd like to start with citizenship. Citizenship's become a popular term in a lot of literature, and I'm not going to address work that doesn't conceptualize that. I just want to note that I think there's an increasing amount of work that uses the term kind of in a fast and loose way. So, but let me tell you what I mean by it and kind of an overview of the concept in the literature as I come to it. First is that there is citizenship as status, which is what most people, academic or otherwise, think of immediately when they hear the term. It's a formal, official, legal status. Now, clearly this is limited as a definition in a lot of instances, but I want to take a moment to still note that the status is still relevant. In fact, in the workshop prior to the seminar, we talked about a couple of examples where it still matters. The status is still relevant, and the politics of its allocation, I think, can be quite revealing in terms of practices of governance and what's going on with citizenship. So whether we're speaking of refugee or asylum policies, the terms or even the possibility of becoming a citizen, of that process of naturalization, the implementation of citizenship tests, as I think we mentioned in passing this morning, the tolerance or permission for dual citizenship, instances of transnational citizenship, the negotiations and machinations around citizenship as a formal status, I think reveal the strategizing on the part of the state and on the part of residents and even non-residents to make that formal status productive in some way. So that insight into the strategy of it is of interest to me. Much of the research on status doesn't actually take up the significance of strategy as much as it critiques it. Usually critique, I'm thinking in particular of work on borders and refugees and asylum, you know, that critiques the limited or exclusionary or discriminatory permission to enter and allocation of citizenship. It's usually critiqued for its inhumanity, quite fairly. But it doesn't take up sort of that further insight about how strategic citizenship might be and how that might be, in effect, an inherent quality of it. We also know, of course, that citizenship is not just a status, that in many instances the status, in fact, is not very central or relevant to citizenship. Here I'm talking about citizenship as it's understood as practice and in practice. And I think this literature has produced two or three, let's say two and a half, key insights. First, that holding formal citizenship does not guarantee, in practice, having the rights that are supposed to accompany citizenship. And there are loads of examples of this. They're very easy to find. There's lots of very good work on people who are discriminated against even though they hold citizenship formally, and that's recognized. And, you know, all the legal stuff is in order, but in practice they are, we usually say, second-class citizens. The second insight, I think, that comes out of the research on citizenship as practice is that having citizenship is not even necessary to act politically in the way that we think of when we think of citizenship. And I'm particularly impressed, I think I would say, by the work of Michael Peter Smith here, who's shown how those without formal citizenship or even formal legal status are successfully able to lobby for rights. That's citizenship in practice. Even without the status. So in some instances, the status may be entirely or relatively irrelevant. the sort of third insight, or like this two and a half, the beginning perhaps of an insight that's fleshed out elsewhere, is that the exclusion of citizenship, or the exclusionary practices of citizenship, this creation of second-class citizens, is not an accident or an oversight. And it's a very important point that I'm going to come back to. And like the first example of the work on status, that doesn't necessarily bring out the significance of the strategic, I don't think this has been this non-accidental nature of exclusion has been brought out as much as it could be either, in particular in the work on citizenship. But I also want to consider that the practices of citizenship, sometimes termed its bundle of rights and responsibilities, but also citizenship in practice, as we've just been talking about, is also misleading in some ways. Because even practices that we have, formal and informal, official and unofficial, these rights, I'm thinking of the official ones especially, that we tend to think of immediately, what passport you carry and whether or not you have the right to vote, both of which came up, I think, very quickly in our conversation this morning. These are great. I mean, these sound really great. But these may not be, when contextualized in a broader sense of political practice, all that they appear to be, or they may not even be all that important, those specific practices. So we need to broaden our understanding of that. And I think that is what the work that Engen and I did 10 years ago now began to do, building on others. I'm not trying to suggest we were pioneers. But we're trying to point to citizenship as a more complex set of practices than any one given ability or right, and put it in a very broad context of political practice. And we built particularly on Marshall's implicitly strategic understanding of citizenship, which I'll come back to, in that we posit citizenship as a technology of governance, that it's a point of negotiation between its alleged citizens, which I'll put in scare quotes for the moment, and the state, and that citizens are created in the process of that negotiation. So it doesn't pre-exist that process, as some of the literature that looks at citizenship as practice or in practice, I think, tends to assume. One of the other things that looking at citizenship as a technology of governance does, too, is it removes or gives you a space in which you can remove some of the morality or ethical questions that kind of get laden onto citizenship. This came up this morning as well, and I'm going to return to that. But I would just emphasize here that kind of along the lines of the way Bourdieu has emphasized that the point is not the class, but the process of classification. So here, too, it's the process of this negotiation, of this relationship, that should interest us if we seek to understand citizenship, not necessarily any given laundry list of, you know, so-called inalienable rights. It's really what is the relationship between citizens and the state. That's the important question, we would argue, in terms of understanding citizens, because that's actually what's producing citizens. They don't pre-exist that. So I think that this insight is partially taken up and partially missed in another area of citizenship studies, which focuses on the activities of civil society and its capacity to mobilize for purposes of social justice in particular. We mentioned this morning that the state, in most instances, has done a very good job of kind of assuming the capacity for dominating the discourse on what citizenship means, what it entails, what it looks like, how we're supposed to behave, so well that I think citizens happily and comfortably agree and take it up. But we forget that, well, sometimes we forget, that the activities of civil society, that other half of that relationship, that negotiation, is just as significant in the formation of citizenship. It has perhaps more potential than it always has action. So the part that is taken up is the part that recognizes that citizenship is a process in which civil society participates, that citizens are not just the object of governance, they are subjects in its formation. But the part that is missed, I think, often, is that if citizenship is co-produced in this way, if citizenship is a technology of governance, then we must get away from citizenship as a singularly positive thing. We must break out of that discourse that I think in some instances once again reduces citizenship to status, just in a different way. Some of the literature in global citizenship, I think in particular, goes in what I would consider unfortunate directions. This literature has a very comfortable and I would even say happy use of the word citizenship as a very positive thing, and I think it falls into this trap of accepting the state's discourse of citizenship as an inherently good thing or even a benevolent gift of the state that's a kind of evidence of what enlightened political beings we are. It in some ways acknowledges citizenship as a technology of governments, but in a very enlightened way. And it becomes kind of, citizenship becomes a kind of code for an emblem of democracy. But I would strongly dispute citizenship in its practices in a very full context as an unambiguously emancipatory, empowering institution. And so not surprisingly, I'm a little bit skeptical of the global citizenship movement's optimism, although I admire it in some ways as well. But there's this optimism for the possibility of political actors uniting across borders, transcending the national state, and usually its evil borders and political practices, exclusionary practices. And through this transcendence, creating a political identity with a global common commitment to humanity, right, instead of to the national state. And I agree it's an admirable wish to transcend bad things, but I think it's vulnerable to an essentialist reduction instead. The invocation of a global citizenship suggests if we all had the status and recognition as global citizens, that is, if we all recognized each other as human beings with inherent rights, we would treat each other fairly and equally. Well, that's probably true. It's almost circular, right? If we all recognized each other as human beings with inherent rights, we would treat each other fairly and equally. In abstract, great. In practice, it actually reduces us to human beings, if I can say that, and steps over differences and their possible consequences. I think it's a misunderstanding of citizenship in practice, and I think it's an extreme version of the belief that citizenship is inherently about equality. Because citizenship does not have a history of creating that equality. It has, as we've noted, been applied very unevenly, right? We talked about this morning and just briefly now, there are second-class citizens. It's not even difficult to find examples of this. Even if we were to focus on the easy symbolic citizenship act of the vote, okay, well, property owners received the right to vote before others. Men received it before women, and we're told that nice women didn't want the vote. Whites received it before persons of color. There's hardly a community that has not been excluded by its enlightened political state at some point. And across various axes of identity, you can look at religion, Catholics, Jews, Muslims. You can look at ethnic background, a racial background, Asian Canadians, African Americans, overwhelmingly indigenous peoples. These have all been excluded because of their identity from citizenship rights, even when they held citizenship at times, by their states. Minors are still excluded, and there are some people who actually take that up as an exclusionary practice. And I think we mentioned this morning in parts of the United States, prisoners are excluded now from the right to vote. So if we can return to those strings I left dangling a moment ago, these were not accidents. These exclusions were not oversights. In all instances, there were erudite statements in the public domain challenging the inequity of the incomplete allocation of rights. As these decisions were made, they were openly and articulately challenged. Historical work on the process of nation building and state building points to this again and again. And it is useful, I think, here to revisit some of this scholarship to remind ourselves of the strategic creation of the state and its longstanding use of nationalism, nationalist subjectivities, and the institution of citizenship to manage its population. You could look at Gellner's study, Nations and Nationalism, which insists that despite active assertions to the contrary that continue today, the state invents its nation. He argues that it is not the case that the state is the successful political manifestation of coherent national struggle, which is partly suggested, I think, by both studies of separatist movements and post-colonial theory. Gellner argues instead that the state, having been brought into existence for whatever reason, finds itself perpetually required to identify its subjects and justify its ability to govern them in order to maintain its legitimacy, and that that's not stable, right? It's a constant dynamic process. Anderson, in different terms, I think, makes the same point as he identifies key processes and institutions through which the state does this, through which the state officially imagines its nation and thus discursively and logistically governs them. For those who haven't read Imagined Communities lately, it's the census, the map, and the museum. Linda Colley did a landmark study of the invention of a British identity in the formation of the United Kingdom, in which she laid bare that both the strategic rationale for such identity construction and the means by which the compliance and even cooperation of citizens was achieved. It is, indeed, through this strategic political process that the institution of citizenship, understood and practiced formally and informally, was established. So we would return to Marshall, whose historical mapping of the emergence of specific citizenship rights similarly unveils this strategic management of the population by the state in his framing of it, in the interests of capital, with particular emphasis on development and control of the labor force. Democracy and citizenship, as we understand them, were not given birth to magically, instantly, at some moment of political enlightenment, usually coinciding with a revolution. Instead, they have kind of staggered very unevenly into existence. But this kind of political economy, especially to lean on Marshall there, is what constitutes the framework of the emergence of the modern nation state and its institution of citizenship, although this is frequently obscured by celebratory nationalist narratives that often speak to, in fact, inclusion. Even in Canada, we commonly assert, we allege ourselves not to be very patriotic and not talk about these things. That's nonsense. We commonly assert that the Canadian nation state is based on a liberal political philosophy that privileges and commits itself to human rights. History in Canada and elsewhere indicates otherwise. When you look at examples such as the institution of slavery, the spatial confinement and identity regulation of Native peoples, the exclusion of women from most political, social, and civil rights, these reveal not just small inconsistencies between the language of equality and the material reality in which people live. These constitute egregious, even paradoxical, crevices between what is trumpeted and what is delivered. Examples of second-class citizenship are not anomalous or even extraordinary. I would argue they are indicators of the fundamental character of the state and citizenship. The state says, by becoming a citizen, you are included and made, actively made equal before it. But the state knowingly distributes rights in an unequal fashion. We cannot then turn around and point to citizenship as an unproblematic means towards equality or the creation of equality. It was not created and employed as such. Moreover, even when it's not inequitable, citizenship is still an uneven process. Necessarily so, particularly when we find that citizenship rights reside in groups in addition to individuals, and you have different rights for different groups in a more positive sense, not an exclusionary one, then we discover that the process of unevenness is, this is going to sound almost contradictory, is consistent. But, for example, these can be based on identity. For example, in both Canada and the United States and in several other countries as well, citizenship policies and rights, specific rights for Indigenous peoples, are different than from non-Indigenous peoples. They're structured differently, but they also actually have different rights. There are Native peoples in Canada, for example, who have rights to access to natural resources that I, as a non-Native, do not. This can also be spatially based, related to identity, but organized differently. And the example I would give immediately from Canada is Quebec, that in Quebec's citizenships and rights of Quebecois are different than in the rest of Canada. So the discourse of citizenship is equality, but in all the messiness, in all the complicating political and historical contexts, we can see that citizenship in practice may be indeed the antithesis of what it appears to be. That in presenting citizens as fundamentally and inherently equal, in that they are equal before the law, they are equal before the central state, right, that everybody gets only one vote, other forms of inequality become either less important or irrelevant, or just not the responsibility of the state, or at least the national state, because they've done what they can, right? We made you equal. That's what citizenship does. So the rest must be up to someone else. Sometimes other scales of formal government, sometimes civil society. In the United States, it is commonly alleged that responsibility for everything else rests with the individual. So from a still more cynical perspective, which I confess to possessing, citizenship and its discourse of equality may even serve to hide or silence other forms of inequality, both things like racial inequality, which is constructed, and the material inequality that is necessarily present in a capitalist society. So to hide such inequality, or to suggest that citizenship transcends all differences and makes us all the same, at least in terms of opportunity, I would argue is profoundly disempowering of citizens. It robs them of knowledge and insight. It robs them of potential political motivation to action. And it serves as a tool that is commonly used for anyone to take up to further disempower those who make claims of inequality, because it enables them to challenge the reality of perceived inequality, to challenge anyone taking responsibility for it, and to challenge the possibility of changing it. If we follow this all the way through, then I would argue that citizens, and now that word is very much not in scare quotes, citizens are disempowered by the very institution that claims to empower them to belong and act politically. Citizenship is therefore a conflict between those who govern and those who are governed from its very presence. It's not a peaceful treaty or contract. It's a conflict from its premise and from its very introduction. If citizenship is a conflict, then as geographers, or the geographers who self-identify as such here today, immediately observe that geography is critical to the outcome of that struggle and understanding it at all, because conflicts are always necessarily contingent. Or to put it another way, actually in the words of Keith and Pyle, this is a quote I really like, politics is necessarily territorial. And then they also note, but these territories are simultaneously real, imaginary, and symbolic. So all of those are going to be taken up in examination of citizenship in the in-between city. So let me tell you what the in-between city is. There's a German planner and part-time academic named Thomas Sieverts, and he wrote a book called Cities Without Cities and coined the term Zwischenstadt, which is to describe, as he puts it, the type of built-up area that is between the old historical city centers and the open countryside, between the place as a living space and the non-places of movement, between small local economic cycles and the dependency on the world market, or the local and the global. So we roughly translate as Zwischenstadt, which is just between city, as in-between city, because it works better in English. My colleague Doug Young describes the in-between city as between the glamour zones, as he puts it, of downtown and suburb, with none of the glamorous traits of either. Sievert suggests that what is now, he argues, the living space of the majority of mankind is an anonymous space with no visual quality. He argues that across all cultures of the entire world now, these places share a structure of completely different urban environments, which at first sight is diffuse and disorganized, with individual islands of geometrically structured patterns, a structure without a clear center. As a whole, he says, the diffuse city gives an unplanned impression, but it has arisen out of innumerable, individual, and considered on their own, rational decisions. So now you can perhaps start thinking whether Milton Keynes fits with any of these qualities. It certainly describes the area around my university, which is one of the reasons that we studied where we live, or where we work anyway. Now, Sieverts credits several forces in the production of this urban form, one of which is the preconditions of the worldwide distribution of labor, the dissolution of the cultural binding forces of the city, and the consequent radical pluralization of city culture, which is connected with it. And in some ways, we should say the worldwide distribution of labor is almost partial code for resultant immigration and kind of hypermobility. He also argues that it is the result of the fact that the contrast between city and nature has dissolved. The growing population due to immigration and the diversity that comes with it, as well as what he describes as too much built fabric, which is the result of increasing and intensifying segregation of activities, also contributes to producing this landscape. That increased segregation, I think, is very important. It's especially between workplace and residence, which is obviously a continuation of a phenomenon that began with the Industrial Revolution. But it's particularly intense and takes on a particular character in the in-between city, where you have a new building or space for every purpose, and as Sieverts also notes in some of those comments, very disconnected one from another. They aren't constructed in relationship to each other. They're constructed for their purpose in the available space. And that's it. Sieverts also notes that the in-between city does not have an independent city, an independent identity, either in the imagination of its occupants or as a subject for politics. I think this is quite a key observation on his part, and I am curious about why. And I'm obviously particularly curious about it as a subject for politics and as a space for politics. To Sieverts' observations, though, I want to add the insights of one of my colleagues in Canada, Jill Grant, that this is also a landscape produced by conflict. And actually in a couple forms. Grant's work, with some colleagues of hers, points first of all to a relatively overt conflict between developers and planners, primarily. Also between developers and residents, and sometimes even between planners and residents, particularly when planners fail to incorporate diversity into their design, which is a common frustration. Developers, especially commercial developers, tend to pursue capital-generating ventures. That's probably a shock to all of you. Planners and residents, however, often incorporate economic development into their agendas, but it's not usually a singular priority. They're usually professional and personal obligations to consider social, cultural, environmental purposes and impacts. In fact, often planners and sometimes residents explicitly seek to set the parameters of all development according to all of those terms. So some conflict thus arises from different goals, ambitions, and frames of reference of the parties. Conflict is also generated increasingly by, and this speaks to Sieverts' comments as well, by differences in the geographic scale at which these parties organize their thinking and their plans. Residents may have goals for their area that situates themselves in their area in several scales, but one of those scales will always be local. It will concern their residents and their immediate environs. They will always be concerned with their own mobility, their own safety, air quality, access to services, and so on. So the strict definition of local, and especially its literal geography, that may vary, but this immediacy and the aspect of personal impact, that's going to be universal. But the in-between city has a landscape that's conducive to thinking big. Its location may be on the outskirts of the central city, and that in some ways makes it undesirable, but it has a desirability that emerges from its proximity to large-scale transport infrastructure, highways, airports, train depots, and the like. The in-between city also has a lot of available space, and there are still industries that need that. It has large spaces, and it has apparently uncontested spaces. Land prices, rental costs, and taxes are relatively low, especially as local states seek to have people come in and develop the area. So there are incentives. So there's a lot of space that's available, and it's affordable. And so this landscape favors what we call big box commercial development, chain stores, light industry, warehouse storage, and distribution centers. So these are facilities that require lots of room, and they are not possible any longer to build in city centers because of space, and they are not possible for political and social reasons to build in the middle of a luxury suburb. So thinking this big immediately orients one, and I think necessarily orients one, to a scale that is larger than the local. And in fact, as Sieverts noted, in the in-between city, much of this development is driven by a desire to access international, global markets. And its proximity to transportation that can facilitate that, then it's quite a symbiotic relationship. But I would also add that the in-between city is also a landscape of conflict in a way that is slightly less overt, and that's in terms of class polarization and class conflict. Or in some ways, it's the avoidance of class conflict, which itself is, I guess, polarizing. The in-between landscape is marked by an uneven distribution of infrastructures in the current global neoliberal urban environment, and here I'm quoting my colleagues, Doug Young and Roche Kyle, in which access to resources is increasingly divided and made more exclusive to those with capital, a process that's also been termed elsewhere as splintering urbanism. Living within the commercial, industrial, transport landscape, that part of the in-between city, those are new immigrants, the working poor, lone parent families. Many of these people live in apartment towers, many of which are publicly subsidized. Living on the edges of that landscape and what we still might call parts of the in-between city, although they're getting themselves out of it as fast as they can, are the kind of housing developments that are more akin to what we associate, at least in North America, with suburban living. Low-density neighborhoods of large detached housing, often on winding roads with few access points and thus little flow through traffic. And these landscapes are rarely interrupted by any other built form than the detached housing. These neighborhoods are usually within driving distance of retail amenities and others, but they don't directly face it. They are physically removed from it. So if we're looking at the more intense part of that, the transport industry landscape of it, what's it like to live there? Well, it's pretty crummy. It's dangerous. It's polluted. It's underserviced in terms of its residential population. It's car dependent, which is very difficult for those who don't have cars, and the populations that I mentioned disproportionately don't. And it's extraordinarily isolating. Public transportation is infrequent and inadequate. It tends to be oriented towards getting elsewhere, usually getting downtown. Public transportation does tend to be regionally planned rather than locally planned. The public facilities, such as schools, government offices, community centers, in the in-between city, as actually in the suburbs, they tend to be large, very large-scale institutions, and they're spread out within the city at great distance from one another. The streetscape in the in-between city is dangerous for pedestrians, especially children. You have wide boulevards and freeways, which host a high level of vehicle traffic, commonly including large trucks and industrial vehicles, at all hours of the day. The vehicle traffic produces noise and air pollution. The commercial landscape produces further dangers for pedestrians as well. These can come from crossing the massive parking lots that lie in front of these establishments, and also because the local traffic, and by this I mean shopping traffic, consumer traffic, stops or slows after normal store hours, making these areas abandoned and empty after dark. And as I mentioned earlier, they're not connected and integrated with other places. In the in-between city, there is an almost complete lack of open public space, especially social or recreational space. As these areas are produced demographically by immigration, as Sieverts notes, there is a strong tendency to have negative racialized stereotypes in the media and elsewhere about these neighborhoods, which I would argue is another obstacle. So that's a lovely list. All of that preceding list, I would argue, erodes the quality of life for people who live in these areas. Everyday life in the in-between city, in fact, is very labor-intensive. It's just very tiring. And that labor intensity, I think, also contributes to displacing possibilities for change. Having said all that, and to return to the attitude of the kids who took the pictures you're looking at, I do want to note that this landscape is nonetheless negotiated in very creative ways, and there's evidence of very impressive resilience. There are small community organizations that managed to pull together very small amounts of public funding along with private donations and copious amounts of volunteer labor in an attempt to meet the needs that the few public facilities do not, especially with regard to children. But I would argue actually social resilience in the in-between city is nurtured primarily through private spaces that are turned to common use, usually due to and reliant on the sympathies of the owner, whether this is actually someone's home or household, or whether it's a so-called third space of a cafe, a tavern, a barbershop, beauty salon, to name a few of the more common spots. These are very significant, and they've long played an important role for all kinds of marginalized groups, but they're also precarious, and they are particularly precarious in the in-between city, which is a commercial landscape dominated by chains. These also raise, this question of social resilience raises another question that perhaps we can return to in discussion afterwards. It raises a key question about responsibility for such public services, social services, between sort of a competition discussion between the state and civil society, but it's not the focus about what I'm talking about today. So, what does citizenship look like in such a landscape, and why is this even an important question? I think this question directly follows from the question of what possibilities might exist or be brought into being to improve this landscape and the quality of life within it through political action on the part of the affected community. So in some ways it's asking what capacities do they have to do so? Well, from some research done in this area around my university, I've looked at these questions surprisingly as a geographer, so spatially, looking at the spaces in which citizenship can be negotiated in terms of staking of new claims, contesting the status quo, and also looking for spaces in which there might be an uncontested realization of claims of citizenship, so spaces in which citizenship might already be practiced. Generally speaking, these are both questions of access to space, and so they are really predicated on these other geographic characteristics of the in-between city, particularly around mobility and lack thereof, and also the channeled or sort of flow through, like the structure of the mobility that does exist. Questions of proximity and distance, which are an important issue, and then the actual existence and then relative location of places of encounter and assembly. So the particular area that we're studying around York University is surrounded on three sides by major highways, one of which is the largest and busiest in North America, the so-called 401. Each of these highways has eight or more lanes. At one point, the 401 has 16. So these are big. In the area is also a major research university, that would be my own, that has 50,000 students. There is also a petroleum storage station, a minor airport, and just beyond our study is a major airport, the Toronto's major airport. There's a major rail yard. There's a large truck warehouse distribution center. There are several large-scale religious institutions that we call big box religion. There are two very large-scale commercial recreation sites. There's a Canadian Forces base, and there is the largest concentration of public housing anywhere in the city of Toronto, and therefore anywhere in the province of Ontario. That's all within this site. The car-based character of this landscape, the scale of travel, the scale of, consequently, of purchasing, is so dominant that degrees of mobility are a means of polarization. Public transit is insufficiently frequent, as I've noted, inadequate, crowded, expensive, poorly sheltered. Toronto's in Canada, mind you. Winter is significant. And thus, driving a car gives you extraordinarily privileged access. It gives you better carrying capacity and therefore lower per item costs, so it saves you money, and extraordinarily, it saves you time. If it's not within easy walking distance for those without cars, and only a few things are within easy walking distance, then it's not likely people will be able to come either randomly or for a specific purpose to any given place. Our preliminary studies of people's movements in this area, those without cars, are that their day-to-day destinations are either very local or they take them out of the area entirely, usually for employment. The meeting places are spare. There are very few places of encounter and assembly in this area. It's an overwhelmingly privatized, commercialized landscape. And you you see that, and you should be able to see that in some of the pictures that you're looking at. There are no other landmarks in these neighborhoods than the commercial and infrastructure landscape. The highway, the 401, is its own landmark because the public housing that you're looking at is literally right beside it. But there's nothing else to guide your way by. If you were to give someone directions, you would have to tell them either street names, which are very difficult to see, actually, but you'd give them, you know, industrial or commercial signage, or when you go under the highway, and so on. There's nothing else you can mark your way by. There is a major creek in the area. Major creek sounds contradictory. And they have taken a name for the area quite consciously, but you can't actually see the creek from the road, so it's not a landmark, and you can't even see it actually frequently from just walking about the neighborhood. So there's no obvious way to identify the neighborhood according to any other marker than this signage. And the other is this identity that's been placed on it, which I'll talk about in a moment. The public facilities that exist in this neighborhood are not obvious. My favorite, and I don't think it's in these pictures, but there's a picture. One of the kids took a picture of the sign for the public library. It's a street sign high up on a hydro pole at one of the major intersections, which itself is 8 lanes wide of a boulevard. Then there's a little arrow sign directing you to the public library. If that's all you had to go on, you would never find the library. The library is actually on a subground level of a nearby mall. Very, very difficult to find without prior knowledge and direction. Not surprisingly, the area we're studying is a match for what Siebert's identified in terms of its population. It's generally not wealthy. It is disproportionately populated by recent immigrants, lone parent families, and so on. These communities have very little knowledge of government institutions, which I'm going to return to briefly as well. But if we think about the need for public space and access to public institutions and resources in order to make a claim, and then any kind of public space that needs to be visible in order for that claim to be seen and recognized by anyone else, then I would have to say it's damn near impossible for this population to be visible to the rest of the city or its state. There's no place to do that. There's literally no location, and any location you might try and claim is not visible, is not going to be seen or recognized by the rest of the city. So there are libraries and there are community centers. But a colleague of mine at the University of Toronto has done some great work that looks at the dynamics of that, which are directly related to the forces that produce this landscape. And the way in which some groups with better resources, usually from those suburbs on the edges of the in-between city, come to dominate public facilities. So the power of civil society may not always come to good for everyone when you've got the kind of uneven, polarized resources of the various communities in the area. In the in-between city that we're studying, there's also a major public institution with many different kinds of resources. That would be my university. There are researchers from many disciplines actively engaged with making a variety of investments in the neighborhood, especially education. But I am sorry to say, and I must include this in this discussion, that as an institution, it has not played a strong role in alleviating any of the challenges of the neighborhood around it. Instead, in fact, it has responded to pressures to secure its property, often against its own striking workers as well, but to secure its property increasingly as a private or privatized space to improve its brand and reputation. And also it has responded to pressures to intensify research in wealthier areas of the Greater Toronto Area that have better cachet with government and business leaders. And I actively get this from officials who I won't name, obviously, at my university, though, involved with research, you know, actively encourage to do research not in this area, but in another area with, you know, greater political significance. Access to public resources and even information is a problem, particularly because there are so few public areas where information might be posted or exchanged. And as I mentioned before, partly as a consequence of that, residents know very little about the structure of government services that they might avail themselves of. They were not aware, for example, in some of the focus group work that we did, of the structure of school boards and trustees, that if they have a problem with their school, there's someone they can talk to besides someone at the school. The public housing that exists, which is certainly a public facility, is not in very good quality. It is also the victim of neoliberal downloading from federal and then provincial governments that in Canada and especially in Ontario have, as they put it, gotten themselves out of the business of public housing. And so they sold, in the case of Toronto, they sold a great deal of public housing to the city for like a dollar a building. It was sort of this great deal until they discovered what maintenance was left undone. So overall, the infrastructure in this area that we're studying is very weak, and it's definitely underserviced for its residents. But it is notably not underserviced and weak for business and industry. They are very well supported in this area, and that's very significant. This is not an area with no investment. What I'm trying to understand here is what happens when you have or try to have citizenship, which, as I've explained, I see as inherently a conflict in a space that's produced by and productive of conflict itself. And I find that citizenship in the in-between city is attacked on two fronts, both of which are rooted in the landscape, but in different ways. The first is, as I've mentioned, the lack of space in which to be political. Lack of public space in and of itself, but also difficulties finding the public facilities and resources that do exist. The second is the negative racialized identification of the area, which is the case of the area in our study. The name of one of the main intersections in that neighborhood is a code in Toronto, easily recognized for a racialized, violent, and crime-ridden neighborhood. You just say those two street names, and that's what you mean. That's what you're referring to. That kind of discourse, there's a lot of evidence of this from the people that we've spoken to, diminishes residents' sense of inclusion and their right to participate, which closes another kind of political space for them. We already know that the citizenship is diminished by weak public institutions, but it's also diminished by weak private institutions. Citizenship needs space for political organizing and conflict, and marginalized communities actually have traditionally sought that in third space of private spaces. Not surprisingly, whether we're talking about big open public space or small locally owned private or third space, the large-scale commercialization and just built form of the landscape in the in-between city does not create that space. But it's also important to note that the state is not creating space for citizenship any more than private interests are in this area. The in-between city is sometimes seen as sort of a non-place. But as Sieberts notes, it's not a non-place. It's not actually out of the loop. It's very much in the loop, right? It's built landscape in terms of its commercial landscape, its infrastructural landscape is important. It receives a lot of care, attention, and investment. There's a lot of money going into the area. But it's going in very unevenly. And so in terms of its residents, it's a landscape full of abjects. Their social life and well-being and political voice is apparently not valued. It's not Agamben's camp. But the rightslessness of that camp is similar here. And what I'm finding is that citizenship in the in-between city, in practice, is very nearly non-existent. Again, it's not that there isn't resilience, it's not that there isn't community organizing, but in terms of having a political relationship with the state, those in particular who live without a car in the in-between city are very nearly stateless people. It's worth noting that observations of the decline or disappearance of citizenship and public space are becoming commonplace. So I'm not trying to say it's just in the in-between city. It's also observed in cities and suburbs, even online in cyberspace. It's observed in particular kinds of relations like labor relations, environmental politics, and so on. But I'm finding it's quite pronounced. This decline or diminishment is quite pronounced in the in-between city in Canada than in other places. And I would argue that it is because this landscape is the epitome of the powerlessness of residents. And it is the epitome, you find that powerlessness in the extreme, because the landscape itself is the epitome of what has been observed elsewhere in terms of the impact of neoliberalism. It's the extreme version of this in terms of the withdrawal of the state and a consequent reliance on civil society to manage, what are deemed local issues, regardless of resources to do so. The enclosure of public common space into commercial or commercialized space, including, in fact, the commercialization of public infrastructure. One of those three highways is a toll highway. Although it's also worth noting that public transit in itself is also a tolled form of mobility, in a way that streets generally are not. Now, the state, as your colleague Engen Eisen has noted, usually competes for space within the city. It wants to occupy and have a presence. But here in the in-between city, with the occasional exception of some local government, it generally chooses not to claim that space in the lives of the citizens. It's not there. And certainly those who live there would argue that we need a reassertion of the local from the state to occupy space in the in-between city on a small, accessible scale. Another approach, though, might be to consider whether or not it's just a question of mobility and the link. And if I consider work I've done on Aboriginal citizenship, if there's better access to the city, to some kind of visibility, then being political can mean going to the city. It doesn't necessarily have to be where you are. But that access isn't there either, especially if you don't have a car. The material and social spaces in which we live must give us the capacity to act politically in a conflictual way, where we can challenge the state without negative consequence or penalty, or else we are not citizens. But the in-between city, this landscape that is emerging as the dominant form of urbanization around the world, this landscape that is neither city nor suburb and cannot be made into either one, is a place very nearly without a state and without citizens. And this is a particular problem for us because we have no planning models for a place that is neither city nor suburb and cannot be turned into one. Thank you.
And we have some time to have open discussion, so would anyone like to open it up?
Actually, I was just really interested in the link with the young people and your paper. The paper had a fantastic context, which is really interesting. But what's their view of this issue? How do they place themselves in relation to these ideas you're talking about, particularly in relation to exclusion? How do they feel about the place? Obviously, we can see these problems with these spaces. And you said at the beginning that they actually enjoy living there. So mm-hmm. I just wondered more about their voices.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the insights and observations that I discussed in our own study, or at least part of those, came out of this work that we did with the kids. Let me just take 2 seconds to tell you what we did. We worked with this kind of summer camp organization run by one of the local civil society organizations, which separates them into boys and girls. So we did one project with the girls and then another project, with the same project again then with the boys, and which also neatly gave us this kind of control so that we can also narrate about gender. But what we did is this community mapping and photography project where we asked them, as you saw a little bit of, to photograph their area. But that was after we had talked about what is it like, you know, to live here, and we made first small local maps, and then the kind of final project for both groups were these enormous community maps, and what they actually, both groups decided to do was paste their photographs onto the map, which also told us quite a lot too, because we wound up with 700 or 800 photographs from the project, and so for each one they had to choose, you know, just a few dozen. So that also taught us a lot. We didn't discuss the concept of citizenship with either of the groups, but we did talk about belonging, and we did talk about what they liked and disliked about their neighborhood. There wasn't much they disliked. And as someone who doesn't live in the neighborhood, and I think, frankly, as a mom, there's a lot I dislike about their neighborhood. A lot of the pictures you saw were of the mall, in which case they were taken by the girls, because the boys didn't even want to go to the mall, although they put it on their map. And it was the only place the girls wanted to go. And it's clear that they have worn a route, because as soon as we stepped out of the building, they all went into autopilot and just followed the route that they obviously always take. So they go from behind their buildings
out to the main road, which is 200 feet. The main road is 8 lanes wide and is under construction, as you saw in some of the pictures. And it's always under construction. It's been under construction right there for years. You immediately go under the 401. At that point, the 401 is at least 8 lanes wide. So we're talking about highway lanes now. And the sidewalk that you walk under this elevated highway, which is only elevated about a story above you, is not even a boulevard sidewalk. So it's about 4 feet wide, and there's no barrier. So you're walking under a major highway next to an 8-lane boulevard like that. It's incredibly noisy. It's very polluted under there from the traffic. And then you come out, and to cross to the mall, you have to cross the 8-lane boulevard that I just mentioned, and then another 6 or 8. I think it's 8 at the intersection because of the turning lane, so it may only be 6 walking alongside it. But you have to cross 2 of those because the major intersection immediately above where they live is these two main boulevards, and the mall is sort of kitty corner from where they live. And then once you've crossed, you then cross once you cross the roads, you then cross this massive, very busy parking lot. And I watch these girls do it, and they clearly do it every day because you probably could have blindfolded all of them and they still wouldn't have been hit by a car. Nevertheless, some of these girls are 8 years old. And while I'm impressed by their savviness, street smarts, and want to encourage the same in my own children, it was truly frightening, to watch them do it. It's not a safe landscape in any sense. They don't see that. They see, look, the mall's within walking distance. And the mall's got all these pretty things. You saw the pictures of the pretty things that they love. I mean, they love everything about the mall. They love the aesthetics of it. They like, they took pictures of the signs at the stores. I think I included a few of those. I think we had to convince someone to take a picture of the library just so it would be in there. Otherwise, we tried not to direct, what they took pictures of. But they really like it. And they point to places that they go, and they point to the school that they go to. It was summertime, so they didn't pay quite as much attention to it as they might otherwise have done. And for the boys, it wasn't the mall. It was more the community center where they play basketball, where girls do not feel welcome. But we imagine that young boys are not welcome at the mall, and that's why they're not joining them. So there's quite a polarization there. Anyway, but it's the same thing. They took pictures of the trophies in the case in the community center that they have nothing to do with. They took pictures of the floor of the gym, with the lines and the paintings and stuff on it. They love everything about it. I think you saw some of the outdoor pictures of stuff. They call the play structure that you saw at the very beginning of the slide the park. It's not a park. It's about as big as this room, that play structure. And it's brand new, and there's a sprinkler beside it, so that's brilliant in the summer, right? But you're talking about 3, 25-story apartment buildings that are right beside each other that share this teeny tiny play structure that would be appropriate for a small daycare. I mean, you as a scholar and a mother, I was going to yell, don't call it a park. Don't glorify it. They absolutely love living there. They have very strong social relationships. And that's key. But they have also found, and created these places that are special and important to them. And their parents have done as well. The parents are a little bit more likely to tell you, actually a lot more likely to tell you what's wrong with the place and what's lacking. But none of them wants to move. They just want it to be improved. They want more public space. That came up a lot. And they want better public transit. That came up every single time. But they like the place. They like the community. They like the beauty salon is where all the women go and hang out and talk and learn what's going on, with other kids and what's happening at the schools and what you can do about it and so on. Like that, it does happen. And they like it. It's just inadequate. And they just wish there were more. So I think that partially answers your question and probably rambles quite a bit.
Three, which may relate to each other actually. The first comes out of what you've just been saying, which I think the whole thing would be interesting. And I was wondering, do you seem to be suggesting that if war, well, first of all, I like the notion of citizenship is about needing to be able to let the person be in a conflictual way, I think that's a helpful way of thinking about citizenship. Then I wonder whether, why you were concluding that that wasn't possible in that space, particularly given what you just said. Because that actually does seem to me to provide the basis for some sort of conflictual engagement. They do actually have those senses of identity and want to make those claims that precisely allows for conflict over the citizenship, over what they want and what they don't want, I think. And I don't know whether one of the other issues for me is actually Sieverts himself and the assertion that this model of living is becoming dominant everywhere and is taking over. I'm not sure in what sense that's true. I don't know what the evidence for that is. I'm sure there's a lot of evidence around Europe. I'm not sure there's evidence for it everywhere else in the world. And I'm not sure that the in-between city in Germany is very much like the in-between city on the edge of Toronto. So I think I'd just like to think a little bit about that. And if that's the case, there do seem to have been some things that have happened in some places that Sievers might have identified as in-between cities. The riots in the banlieue in Paris, it seems to me, were precisely claims for citizenship, different sorts of citizenship, so precisely created possibilities to act politically in a conflictual way. They may not have resulted in very obvious ways of resolving that, but it does seem to me that there is stuff in these spaces, or some of these spaces, which is not, or some of these places that might be called these spaces, that might be called special städte, if one actually believed that they all could be labelled in quite a straightforward way. There do seem to me to be opportunities. I wondered why you were suggesting that there were. That was one of the things. The final thing, which in a way also relates to something you just said, and I think maybe you've answered this question, but it is about the extent to which these places are temporary or permanent. In other words, looking at the places you just look at, it looks to me like something that is highly fragile, but actually the development process is not necessarily going to leave this place like that forever or for very long. That's one thing. The second thing is, it's not clear to me in many of these places, now it may be different if it's public housing, but it's not clear to me that in all of these places the population is going to stay the same over long periods. Is this a zone of transition? Are we back to Chicago really in the 1930s? It's another question that it raises for me. So I think it's absolutely fascinating looking at these places, and I think the work you've done is really exciting. I mean, I think actually I start worrying about it. Incidentally, and just for the sake of completeness, just to say, well, this is what Milton Keynes is like. No, it's not. Milton Keynes is highly planned as a starting point.
And, the entire thing is
planned, so that doesn't quite work. You do sometimes have to cross big roads, but there are underpasses normally. Nobody will be taking any risks. But more important, actually, on the individual estates, everything is quite highly and horribly protected. It is true that they don't have much in the way of public transport, and the public transport delivers people to the mall, which is the downtown CBD or whatever you're trying to call it. But in some respect, you could argue that some of the things about Milton Keynes are like a between cities, right? Some aspects of it. But what's interesting is, if the definition of an in-between city is that it's unplanned, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So actually they've planned for this warehousing of these big boxes. They've actually planned it in quite a sophisticated way. Lots of very nice landscaping.
Well, if I could answer these, I'm trying to answer them a bit in reverse order, because you raised I think some important aspects of the in-between city that'll help me answer the rest of it. Which is, I think, what Sieverts is trying to say, and as I said, Grant's work that's followed is actually part of our project, is that they look like, I mean, if you look at the area, I was saying this to Scott, if you just look at the area, you would think, oh my gosh, where were the planners? It looks unplanned. It looks like a landscape of neglect. It's not unplanned. And what Sieverts is trying to say, that it is the product of all these rational decisions. The point is that they're not planned coherently as a region. They're planned, you know, one bit at a time, and that each bit is a contest in which there are winners and losers, and there's no relationship between whether
you know, what was done in this space and what gets done in the space beside it, except that usually developers can use any precedents that were in their favor to say, well, they got to do it. You know, you waive that bylaw in terms of a height restriction or whatever for them, so you should do it for us. I mean, there's that. But other than that, there's no explicit relationship between the spaces. But it does still sound like it's a distinction between this area, which I don't know well. It's just something that someone said to me. And the so-called in-between city. But I would also note that I don't think that either Sieberts, and certainly not myself and my colleagues, I don't think that any of us is trying to set up the in-between city as that distinct a place that it shares no characteristics with any other. I think there are aspects of the in-between city that it shares with cities and that it shares with suburbs. Sprawl actually takes lots of different forms. Density takes lots of different forms. Because this area is the densest in the city. In the city of Toronto, it's more dense in this in-between city area, especially in the immediate region where there are all these apartment towers, some of which are publicly subsidized, than the downtown is. The population density is higher. So you'd say, well, that's very urban. You know, but then you look at the rest of the landscape, and it's not. So it's kind of a mishmash of qualities, some of which are shared with other kinds of landscapes, and then I think the agglomeration it's trying to identify is different. And I think it is that kind of piecemeal planning. And I would agree that Sieberts doesn't go far enough in terms of, and he identifies these very large factors and trends that produce the landscape, but not the more particular one. And I, like I said, I think there's some work that's come out of our own project, not by myself, but by some of my colleagues, that is getting at that, and it's very insightful for us. And so then, what kind of citizenship and political action is possible within such a landscape? I do think I hedged my bets very nicely by saying nearly impossible and nearly non-existent. And I think that's important, because I think what I'm trying to look at are the obstacles. And I have real concerns about the precarious quality of any effort to organize. For example, the community that I was just speaking of and the women who do organize, for exchange knowledge about stuff like the schools, in the salon can only do it because the owner of the salon, you know, is sympathetic to that and allows that. And owners are more able to do that than someone who is managing, you know, the branch of such and such a chain. It's possible in places where there is a desire for that kind of institution to serve multiple purposes, not just to be a commercial establishment, but to serve those social, political, all kinds of needs. And I think that's important, not only that we recognize those spaces, but when we think about what are possible solutions, and I'm not a planner and or a landscape architect or anything, and so I don't necessarily know exactly what the solutions would look like, but I think they don't necessarily look like more public space in the way that we think of in terms of cities or suburbs. Because marginalized communities, such as the ones who live in this area, don't tend to seek those out as places to organize. They have traditionally used these so-called third spaces. So I would be more interested in what kind of strategies might support the continued existence of those, because I think they are precarious. You know, these kind of small strip mall places which you saw in some of the pictures have a very hard time competing with the large big box malls that are right next door to them. So their existence is precarious. So it's not non-existent, but it's very precarious, and I think I just want to emphasize that. I think your example of Paris actually is excellent. And I think it speaks to another question that we might ask, which is what form is it going to take? Because one of the things I think that happens when opportunities for kind of a more routine, everyday, ad hoc kind of political relationship with the state, when those are kind of squeezed out, which is also the case in the example in France, then what you get in terms of political action, a form of political action actually for which I have a lot of respect, but you get an explosion. You get riots. Now, I'd say the difficulty. I don't know what the difficulty for some, certainly in terms of the way a lot of people reacted to that, and I know that the fear that some people felt, you know, even in North America, I mean, I don't know if it was the case here, but certainly the pages of Toronto newspapers were full of, could that happen here? Because even they recognized the kind of, you know, landscape and demographic similarities. And then, of course, all the reassurances that no, it won't happen. But is it that historically those are very successful? That's a very successful way of acting politically for those communities. Changes tend to come. Follow that when they don't come through, you know, the usual sort of standard calm, quiet channels. So I guess it depends on kind of where you stand in that question as to whether or not it's a good or a bad thing for normal, everyday, calmer relationships to be squeezed out. I should have answered this earlier. How dominant a landscape is this? That's a fair question. I think especially, is the in-between city the same everywhere? No. It's not. Just as suburbs are not. There was a scholar visiting in Toronto a couple weeks ago presenting on the suburbs and had a very interesting discussion about how, you know, kind of what we mean by suburbs aren't exactly the same and there are differences, and then we were trying to find out whether there was anything in the term that was the same, and we eventually decided that there was. But I think it is complicated. I think the basic impulse to identify some kind of form that is new relative to the previous urban and suburban development that was going on in that area, I think that's on the mark. And I think that's on the mark in Europe, in South America, in Asia, in North America. I agree with you, I don't think they're identical, and I'm the first to say that, you know what, the specifics of those places and the specifics of those development and the specifics of what's producing that landscape in that way, that really matters. So what we might take from Sievert's is at least as a vocabulary rather than tight, you know, criteria. I think we could be a lot more cautious there.
I've got about five questions, but I'm only going to ask one right now. I'll come back to the others.
Okay.
I just ask it because going back, I just wanted to dwell on the idea of the in-between in the in-between city a bit more, because one way of thinking about the in-between is that it is a produced space out of various things, but actually one form would be the space that is between somewhere and somewhere else. And I get the sense that this may be where this is a place where nobody kind of goes unless they live there or work there, that it's not, you know, it's between because there's no here except for those who work or live there. So there's a kind of, that's two different kinds of in between, right? It's between somewhere and somewhere else, but also a here that is not here. Then there's the not planned, or the piecemeal development versus planned kind of between. So I wasn't sure what that was between. Then there's there seems to be a set of judgments being applied, which are about whether there's a here. In other words, it's kind of boxes which have things like malls, warehouses, and McDonald's in. So it's almost like it's between because it's a bunch of boxes. It's almost like Lego. So it's a Lego landscape rather than something that has cute houses. So there's an aesthetic betweenness of it. It's not cute houses, it's not skyscrapers, so there's an aesthetic between. And I was just wondering, and there are some others, actually one of them I think that links, some of this is provoked by the kids. The local and the global. So there's a scale thing going on. The wide highways, the narrow culverts. So there's some sort of a set of between scales that are between being produced that are too big to cross but too small to walk down. You know, they're not quite the right scale of things. They're not. The highways are too big and the walkways are too small. It's local and global, but not there. So I was just wondering to reflect on whether the between, you know, because these are all now being joined up in the nature of the between, and I was just wondering whether it wouldn't actually be worthwhile disentangling the betweennesses somehow and trying to identify because they then start to talk to different ways in which one might be a citizen or not within some of these things, the agencies or not, that people might have to control or understand where things are. And actually I do have a follow-up, because then I can quite see the state. Because your logic about the state, actually citizens keep jumping you into the space of the state. And that isn't between, it's above the in-between citizen. And I was just wondering about how that articulates out.
I would
sorry about adding a second.
Sorry.
I said I'd only ask one, but
it's a small one.
Yeah.
The state's always a small question. Yeah. I think that if I could start with the more literal material in between stuff, which I think is where Stevert starts, I think they are related. I agree with disentangling them, but I don't think they disrupt each other. I think that that these urban forms take the location and the form that they do because of what was there before, because they were the spaces in between that linked one place to another. And so some of that infrastructure, like highways and rail systems and so on, and that linked the region to other places, so it was in between the local and the global, or even just, you know, the regional and the national. These were the places that were in between, that were the connectors, quite literally, in terms of infrastructure. And then the in-between city grows up around them because it goes to them precisely because that stuff is there, right? It's important, I think, to recognize and get by my own and others' aesthetic judgments of the place that there is a desirability to this landscape. And it's related, actually, the other form, which we haven't even mentioned, it's related, I think, to edge city development as well. And it shares stuff in common with them, but there's a bit more, back to Alan's point, there's a bit more coherence in planning to edge cities than there is to this. And so because it grows up or emerges in the area that it does for that reason and in the way that it does, because it isn't part of a coherent planning, it's opportunistic in that sense. That then contributes to the sense that there's no here, because there isn't a desire to create a here, or here, there, or there, there. And so I think those in-betweennesses are connected, the literal and the metaphorical, and then or the experiential. And then I think what happens from there, to take a few other aspects, is a kind of an academic phenomenon of it then becomes metaphorical, because as you use this language, you start to see kind of other in-betweennesses, or you said, oh, you know, it becomes fortuitously, you know, helpful to continue that language. But I think it is grounded in ideas that are different but are related.
But I guess my point is,
yeah,
is that if one sees a similar form, then you can start to presume a similar betweenness when the nature of these different processes that might have combined in this instance to produce the between are actually totally different. So I think it's how you could make how somebody could make the link between South Milton Keynes and what's going
yeah.
on there is because the form is similar, so there it. So you think it, and it is between. It's Milton Keynes is between London and Birmingham, and between, but it's not quite the same. But the word entrains all the other thoughts, and yes, that's
what I'm
wondering about is how many things are being entrained, but also questioning, you know, wanting to unbundle it precisely so that one doesn't make category errors through similarity of form.
Well, because the timing of it strikes me as key. If something becomes in between because something is put there that is between, in your case, London and Birmingham, that's different from something being built where the connections that linked other places were, and taking the opportunity of that. And I think that's also where the distinction in a different way lies between the in-between city and edge cities. I think they are similar in some ways, in the same way that edge cities are similar to suburbs, but they are different, and because there's a timing aspect to them as well. And I think this is what is significant, and I think this is also where the concern about it being or becoming a dominant form comes from. It does, have a certain logic to it in terms of, or evolutionary logic to it in terms of the development of the city and suburban form. Because if a city is a city, that makes no sense. The existence of a city speaks to trade beyond the city, right, by definition. And so somewhere in the environs of a city, there will be these places. They will not grow up around ports in the same way because the space is not there to. If the CBD is still there, it hasn't been evacuated like in the United States or something, it will still be there. And even if you do have space, the idea that you're going to put in this kind of stuff downtown, it will be resisted, right? But in other areas, you know, if you're talking about train or truck or air transport, that will be there for a city, right? And suburban, especially well-to-do suburban development, will not be right next to it, right? There will be a space in and around that. Now, in a lot of cities, you didn't then put residential development right in the midst of that. But increasingly, we are. And there is this, it's another kind of in-betweenness. I probably don't want to do that, do I? But then you have, because it's coinciding, not coincidentally, with gentrification in a lot of these cities, you have a marginalization of poorer populations that necessarily move there. They can't afford to live in the suburbs either, especially if they don't have a car. So this is where they go because it's left to go. And so then there's the demand, which justifies the planning and developing decisions to continue to intensify the residential development in a place that probably shouldn't have residential development. You then suggested, I'm trying to remember how it connected. I also want to talk about the scale and the local and the global, because at one point in the paper I had a little sort of tangent into that and sort of, you know, Giddens co-constitutive stuff, and I left it out partly because the paper was getting too long to present, but also because it did seem kind of a tangent into something that was really very big, but you raised it so we kind of get into it a little bit, which is that one of my frustrations with some of that literature is how comfortably two-way it is. This is not really a two-way street. This is really, I think, an example of one impacting the other more than vice versa. But also, I think it's an example of kind of two forces that are sometimes in conflict, as Grant's work points out. You know, so you have this kind of warring landscape, not a neat co-constitutive thing, but like these forces that have not stopped pushing at each other, and that sometimes then also then just ignore each other, that they just, you know, kind of locally, logistically, I mean locally in terms of in a place, coexist. And I was going to say peacefully coexist. They don't peacefully coexist. They conflictually coexist. And I don't find that global-local co-constitutive gives me anything, you know, to do. So it would either be to open this huge other thing or to just ignore it, which is what I chose to do. But I think you're raising it. I think it's an important aspect of this that needs further thinking. Now, where is the state in that? I don't agree that the state's above. I don't think I like that metaphor. I think the state is. I think the state takes form. I like Ingen's piece about kind of the virtual and the literal, you know, city-state piece. I just kind of assume that everyone's read. You know, I don't know why I would. Anyway, but he argues that the state has both material and virtual existences and prefers that to thinking of the state in terms of nested scales, right? And so that's what I was referring to, actually, when I talked about, you know, this. He argues the state, like, occupies space in the city, you know, and becomes an actor in that way, like, quite literally, you know, it puts its offices where it does, and they have the visibility that they do, you know, for particular reasons, and it's not just the grandiose parliaments, although those obviously have a lot of powerful architecture, but there's a strategy to the other choices and architecture as well. I don't know what to make of the really ugly 60s stuff that we have in Canada for a lot of federal buildings, but be that as it may, it's not very visible in the in-between city. They're not looking at that as a place that says, you know, we need to be there. there are citizens that we to whom we need to provide services. Instead, it continues to think in an in-between city way in terms of the business and industry side of that. It tends to think big. It tends to think large scale. So it will have one large central office, like one federal building for an entire region, that serves every purpose that the federal government, every service that the federal government might offer. There's some benefit to that kind of one-stop shopping, but it's very, very difficult to access. And it also means that the state is not, like, visibly present. And that seems to lead, from talking to people, that seems to lead to a lack of knowledge about it. And also, I think the large scale, it's certainly my impression from some comments, the large scale kind of building of the provincial government does this too, where you put everything in one big building, has the same kind of effect that the legislature does. It's intimidating. And for new immigrants, that's not insignificant. So I think that there is an argument, but this returns to that question I referred to at the beginning about, well, whose responsibility is it to provide these social services? And to whose advantage is it to organize it this way or that way? Because I think you can argue it both ways. On the one hand, you can argue that the state should be more visible, more present, that they should, and on a small local scale, so that it's actually accessible for people who live there. So that there should be all kinds of offices, and maybe even small commercial establishments, in the ground floors of public housing, mixed use. So bringing one urban idea that can actually be put in there. That kind of thing. More mixed use of the schools. Interestingly, I've got a colleague who's looked at education and school closings, because there have been a lot of school closings despite an increased population in Ontario over the last 10 years, 10 to 15 years. And schools that served a multiplicity of purposes that included, for example, daycare centers or after-school programs are disproportionately more likely to be closed than those that didn't. So that's a whole other thing, but it's another example of where public facilities could be more visible in the role of those services and the role of the state, and so citizens' ability to access the state for its needs could be more visible. That's one argument. The other is to say, no, this is good, because the state moving in would be immediately described by every scholar I can think of as, this is the state policing its citizens a little bit more closely. Like, they were absent, and then they realized that this was exactly the neighborhood that the media describes it as, and, needed greater surveillance, right? And so putting government offices of any type in the, bottom floors of a public housing facility could easily be seen as a negative thing as well. I'd be one of the people probably, interested in that argument. And so keeping the state absent, might be to a marginalized community's advantage. They might prefer the model I referred to very quickly at the end of, no, don't come here, just improve my access to get to you. Stay downtown, that's fine. Just make it easier for me to get there, and then I want to come home to a place where actually you're not in my face, especially in this neighborhood where, the most common face of the state is the police. And there's not always a very positive relationship there. The concern with that, I have a lot of sympathy for that kind of approach, but the concern there, of course, is that it also lets the state off the hook. And the state does have an obligation and is providing those services to its other citizens with more capital, and that's just fundamentally unjust. So I don't have a clear answer to that, but I think you raise really important questions that I've only answered kind of incompletely.
I just wanted to pick up on the automobility kind of question. So I think that, I thought in your kind of in-betweenness, what you captured so beautifully was that sort of being caught in the kind of the interstices of automobility and being kind of missing out on that. I thought one of the photos that really kind of touched me was the wheel, the chrome, like kind of a, obviously a boy photo. Sort of,
real,
sort of, I just see an automobile. It may or may not have ever, realised. And I was just kind of thinking that sense of the automobile, both as a kind of vehicle of citizenship, but also as a kind of a contested object of citizenship. And of course, hanging over all this is the whole kind of climate change politics thing. What you're kind of dealing with here are the people who are already missing out on water mobility. What you've got with a whole lot of kind of climate change responsibilities is the fact that an awful lot more people could slip into this, what from the outside looks not particularly appealing, gap between water mobility. And it's almost like these, when there is a kind of contest over climate change politics, and it's sort of the governed and the governing, and the kind of responsibilities of states to come up with the responsibilities over kind of climate and over carbon emissions. What you've got for the people who kind of don't want to support that is that the threat of falling into these sort of gaps between water mobility that kind of captured here, in which I don't think people don't want to fall into that crap business.
It was fantastic. Yeah. In fact, it's even better that it wasn't a question because I don't have to answer it. But but no, I think it's I really like the connections you made too between the pictures and this obsession with cars and the aesthetic of cars, and which is also expressing this desire of for mobility that's so key to living there. And I would only add that it's almost like a high note. That in this, the in-between city has a slight advantage over some suburban areas, because as poor as their connections are, they're better than suburban areas that have virtually no public transit. And so people who find themselves carless, or in the last couple of years when we've had some of those gas price hikes, suddenly find they can't afford to drive their cars, they're in worse shape, they're in a deeper gap, a deeper crevice than those even in the Twin City.
So these people have practiced already.
Yeah. But they are also, I think, instructive in terms of the danger ahead, right? Mm.
I want to really get back to this question about the kids who like living in this place. And you also said the parents don't want to move. We were talking in the workshop session this morning about how attachment and feelings of belonging in a place is an important part of citizenship. And I think you also mentioned that the stories that are told about this area, derogatory stories about this area, is seen as a problem. In addition to all the material disadvantages of the area, the stories that are told about this area as deprived and crime-ridden is also seen as a problem. And I was just thinking that there is, it seems to me that one of the things that is necessary for positive citizenship action in this area is to build on that sense of belonging and attachment, and that these stories about the place is a problem to that, and perhaps also something that could be contested. And that brings me to this slight feeling of unease about this language of in-betweenness as being potentially disempowering.
And how many times in the last hour have I called them marginalized? Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's just my comment.
No, I think it's an important one. I should note for those who were not so fortunate as to join us at the workshop this morning, was that we read an entirely different paper, but wound up talking about some of the same themes, obviously, around citizenship. I guess I have two responses that I think at the moment still kind of contradict each other a little bit. The first is that I completely agree with the importance of countering negative stereotyping narratives of these places. And this project, as well as another one that a colleague of mine at UWT is doing in a neighborhood in the eastern part of the city, are quite consciously collecting stories and trying to tell a different narrative. One of the things that we've done out of this project, actually, is that some of some of the photos, I don't think there were, there might have been a couple in this display, but I think they're these different ones. But we had a small photo exhibit of some of the kids' photos at the university. We were also trying to create an opportunity to cross the border into the university, into that space for the kids and their families. But there's a large kind of multi-sided photo festival, photography festival in Toronto every year called Contact. And so we were part of that, and it was to put up exactly a different way of looking at this neighborhood. And to their credit, you know, some of the newspapers in Toronto have occasionally spent an entire week. That's not fair. Some of them have done extended series, you know, trying to tell other stories about the neighborhood, trying to at least give it some context. They don't have a lasting effect, but I think that's the nature of stuff that's in the newspapers today. But because that code, you know, for the neighborhood and stereotype of the neighborhood, those are very hard to dislodge. You know, with a few pieces, it would need to be on a regular basis that good stuff comes out of that neighborhood. It doesn't hit the papers. Having said that, I would turn to my comment about, you know, my sort of humorous anger at the kids when they called this play structure a park. I have reservations about what happens in terms of our thinking and our attitudes and the way we might be manipulated by describing things that are problematic as positive, right? I would want to celebrate the positive things about the neighborhood. I would not want them to continue to call a play structure a park. It is insufficient. And language that says it's not hides the fact that it is. And there's a recent book published in North America by an American journalist, some of you may know, Barbara Ehrenreich, about, I can't remember what it's called, Sunny Side Up, I think it's called. But it's a critique of optimism, and it's a much more dominant kind of phenomenon in the United States, but it exists in Canada too. You know, but this insistence that we always see the bright side of things and that we celebrate them, it's definitely one of the ways we're manipulated into not fighting for, you know, not complaining, right? And not fighting for things that need to be changed. And so, I mean, that's an exaggeration. That's not what's happening here. And I think there are positive things to say about this neighborhood and others like it. But I think there are also some really difficult things that need to be said about it. And it may be that the residents of that neighborhood, or at least the younger ones, you know, can't say it because there's too much risk for them in saying it, in which case other people should. Because there are plenty of people with responsibility and authority who should and do know better and should be doing something. You know, to address any, just so many of the egregious things that are wrong with the neighborhood and other spaces in the city. So it's, which is to say that it's complicated and messy. Which I love.
Oh, just come back to what Nigel said. You've got the tower blocks there, which just aren't conducive to having car ownership in themselves. So the structure of the place isn't enabling people to use their cars. But more to do with the relationship between the communities. The way you describe it, it sounds like you've got pockets of residents. And I wonder how much they interact. And I also wonder how much they interact with the industrial side of things, because it's almost as if you've got two coexisting communities sort of laid against each other. You've got the residents and you've got this industrial thing. Mm-hmm. I wonder how closely those two interact. And is it the space, use of the space, are they using it as in theory? So they have this industrial landscape where they are putting new people, new migrants, creating new spaces for them to live, rather than creating new urban areas.
Mm-hmm. For the first part, in terms of interactions, There are some. There aren't many among the different communities, and over time they're pulling away from each other. Well, that is to say, you know, there's middle class flight those are the people who want to move out. So the suburban development in and around these areas is increasingly kind of fenced off and gated more so than you generally would used to find in the area. It's really striking, actually, sort of in the northernmost area of our study area, I was quite surprised to see very, very well-to-do developments that are as, you know, kind of, they use every kind of physical landscape strategy to create distance. When they couldn't create physical distance, then, make it less visible from the road, all the orientations, all that. So they're pulling away from each other. There are conflicts. I don't want to make it sound like there's armed conflict between, kind of middle-class suburban housing and the apartment building. There isn't. But there's just not much contact between them. I mean, in the case of the three towers that you've seen in the pictures, they're actually across the street from the beginnings of a more kind of middling suburban housing. All of the maps that the kids drew start with their apartments at the bottom. That neighborhood across the street is not part of their daily life. So that was quite tough, and vice versa. Because the other thing is, then the folks who live in that neighborhood beyond are not like the kids and their parents, they're not walking up to go to the same mall. So they may go to the same malls and developments and so on, but they're driving there. So they're in the same space and yet, as you say, like coexisting. And I think it comes back to some of what Steve was saying too about, and my answer to him about the way in which these things coexist without touching, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It isn't inherently a bad thing, but I think it has potential problems. In terms of the state's use of space, is it infilling? Yeah. I think that's the nature of the whole landscape, is that it's done piece by piece, and each bit is, okay, there's a space there, we can use that. We need it. Because the parties participating in the development, including the state, but also those beyond, are coming, largely from outside. And so they're just looking for a piece that's, this big. It's not starting from a plan to develop this area for the residents who live in that. Now, in terms of the relationship between those spaces and the residents, that's a central concern. And for people who have cars, it's a coexistence thing. And for people who don't have cars, these very much impact each other. One way. They're very much impacted by the traffic that those sites generate, the noise and pollution. And in an extreme example, there was a propane depot, and I do say was, in the study area that exploded, or there was an explosion there when someone was refueling about 18 months ago, I guess now. And I could hear it where I lived. I live about a 15-minute drive. It sounded like bombs in the plural going off one after another, which is because that's basically what it was. And that was right next to sort of more working-class housing, both apartment buildings and small houses. And, so close that it blew up people's windows. And so that was put there in a sense of, okay, well, we've got room there. And as I said, it's still not planned in this kind of coherent sense for people who live there. There are people who live there, but that doesn't seem to factor in. So I don't know which one went in first and which one in second. I think the site was there before the residential development went in. Two of my colleagues have written about this. But it's just striking that nobody said, hey, that's not a good idea. These are not meant to reside or be located one next to the other. So they do interact, but generally not in good ways.
I'm going to resist the temptation to squeeze in a question because we're pretty much at 4, and I know that people like to end at 4. So if we could give another round of applause.